I guess you're supposed to do that to alert the recorder. I've been recorded many times in the village and never ended up in the library. So it's, I don't, you know, it's kind of wasted motion, but at least they use the tape over again. You know, it's not like, well, the topic tonight is the question, what is ordination? And I guess if I were to give it another topic, more germane to what I'd kind of like to get at tonight, and I hope we can have plenty of time for discussion, to be more ordaining the extraordinary, because I think that's what really is implied. This matter of ordination, as I think it was vividly shown us in the service Sunday evening, was a matter of the community. And that's sometimes something that we lose sight of, I think, and that's kind of the angle that I'd like to approach on. Either that or living the politics of the clergy or the preacher or whatever, that's another way of going at it. The thing that I think is would be my basic statement, and one of the things that I've found in working with this whole topic for I think 30 years would be about right, is that I promised myself here the last couple of years especially, where I've had to give some lectures in this area, that I would never do it unless we had an overnight. There is something about this subject that just defies, real good discussion until you get people together for about 6 hours, and then you go at it, and then it's kind of fun. I've noticed that lately I've always been put on the program either at the very end or at the, right before the dinner hour. Here it's to be squeezed into just before the only service that we have to all go to here in the camp. So we obviously are not going to go over time tonight, no matter what. If you heard that service that was so beautifully written and done, on Sunday night, one of the things that you couldn't help but detect was a phrase that I like to use. That is, your baptismal certificate is your ordination paper. And as soon as we could digest that as a church body, I think we could begin to make some sense out of both what the New Testament teaches and what I think is demanded for this hour in the life of the church. Because it's never been, I think, questioned that our baptism was that which placed in our hands, as it were, something that we'd call a mythical ordination paper or certificate. And that is, I think, where the starting program goes. The problem, as I see it, and maybe some others here would want to take up on this, but the problem is that when we talk about such things as the calling, the called people of God, or even in the more churchy sense, the priesthood, universal priesthood of all believers, we're just kind of out of sync. You know, it's like a rotary thing that's trying to engage with another rotary thing and a cog, and they're just out of sync about a quarter of an inch, so they never quite connect. And that's where I think, we could sit down and talk about stewardship, and man, we'd have all kinds of discussion, and we could talk about evangelism, and we can do those kind of churchy things, but when we get into this whole business of the called people of God, that's when we, it seems to me, have some problems. We kind of tested this out in our district the last couple of years. We've been doing, not only as many other ALC districts have been doing, something called Equipping the Saints, which has been, I think, a very big boon to deeper understandings in this area around the church. And we had an interesting session before our last national convention, which was called the Unfinished Reformation. Joe Sittler really led, together with others, led us into what that aspect of the Unfinished Reformation is. And of course, it is in this whole area of what it means to be the called out people of God. We've taken some people who have been in occupations, and of course, this isn't really where it's at necessarily, except that it's one aspect of this whole question. Taking some people in medical area, taking some people in the farming area, agricultural area, taking people in the teaching professions, and brought them out for an overnight, and really gotten at it, in mostly discussion form. The amazing thing that has happened out of that is that I run into those people in our district over and over again, and you know, they say, we were so totally confused for 5 or 6 hours that we thought we were ready to go home. You wanted to stay, have a stay overnight, and we did. And then some light bulbs began to go on, and that was a very, very helpful thing. A thing that I think really got into their innards in ways that many times our retreats don't tend to do. Now, obviously, there is such a thing in the church as the clergy and the laity. The clergy, we have said, is set aside, set apart, ordained for particular functions. The Alban Institute, which is probably, I think, about as good a research outfit in the life of the church today because they have some theological reflection about what they do, made a study about 10 years ago that asked the laity, what are the absolute essential tasks that the clergy have? And they came up with about 11 essential tasks that the clergy had in their eyes to perform. Recently, about 2 years ago, they did the same questionnaire, and it's much more detailed than this, of course. But what they came up with was 44 tasks that they think the clergy are supposed to be doing in this day and age. And they weighted it just as heavily as the 11 tasks, you know, a decade before. So the rising expectations, of course, are something which all clergy persons are dealing with in a big way in our time. I think also it's helpful to look back a little bit and to say, you know, what happened after Second World War, where I and others in this room came out of and ended up at a seminary. And it seemed to me that at that time, the big raison d'etre for being a preacher was the whole counseling ministry. I mean, it was all over the place. There were books coming out all over. And you sort of justified your existence by being an amateur counselor. Well, I don't think that really fits very well, and certainly with all of the services that are offered in our society in this area, that has become really less than meaningful as a justification for the pastor's task. Along about maybe in the middle 60s and 70s, there came along systems analysis of one kind or another, and everybody bought into that for a while, and you know, that was kind of the thing to do and to be, and so a lot of that was being done. I think there are some of us who feel now that maybe we are ready to justify the pastor's existence on only one ground, basically, not only the functional grounds, but the ground of being a trained theologian. I was in a conference where we had some lay and clergy about evenly divided, and I was asked to give a couple of lectures in this area, and it got very heated in the course of the thing, and so the fellow that was in charge of it in Wisconsin decided that it would be a very good thing if we had a panel of some lay persons, and I would sit with them, and so we discussed this thing, and one of the beautiful women there, about 55 years old, and you know, she said, you know, I belong to a little congregation where we'll never get anything else but seminary seniors. We just, that's the way it is. We get them every 3 years, we train them, and then we kick them out, and they go somewhere else. And she said, you know, I've been waiting for the first one in the last 20 years who would come into our parish and say, you know, I've just gotten all kinds of biblical studies under my belt, both in the New Testament and the Old Testament, and I've really gone after some systematics in theology, and I've studied some church history, and I've got some practical notions about theology as well. And I'd like to take some of my notes and regurgitate those and maybe, you know. And she said, I look at our congregation as a mini seminary, and I'd like to see my pastor be the theologian in residence in that mini seminary and do that kind of job. That's what he's trained to do. But he comes up with, now I'm loading it, with transactional analysis and with PT and with all kind, or the latest book that he read or whatever. And we never get down to those kind of basic things that have to do with our theological formation. Well, I think the church and the congregations of the church are ready for being, as it were, mini seminaries, and and allowing their pastors to not only perform the work of preaching, teaching, and administering the sacraments, but to become that mini seminary teacher who is a theologian in residence. And I think that's beginning to come more and more. Maybe it's different in your part of the woods, but I sense that's very strong in where we are. Now, that's to say, of course, a very simple thing that it took about 30 years of the group dynamics movement to come up with, and that is to say that if we are going to do anything as an organized body of human beings, and that certainly wasn't a scriptural insight, but one they came up with by trial and error, and if you were along in that movement 30 years ago, you knew that it was pretty chaotic and pretty, you know, pretty hokey. But it seemed the one insight that I think they have come up with is that after all, a group functions not by those who have status in the group, but by those who are performing certain needed functions at any given moment. And that's, I remember trying to reach, we had a cream of the crop of young people that came together here several years ago at one of our seminaries, I was trying to explain to them what I thought servant leadership was all about and all that kind of thing. And in the midst of it, it was a hot July day and it was very warm. And so I looked up and said, you know, we really need some windows open around here. And so two people immediately got up and opened all the windows. You know, here are all these leaders, you know, these kids 17 years old with their enzymes just boiling over. And who would they be but the president of our church, who happened to be there as a guest to speak, and also the president of the seminary. And I thought to myself, you know, there's another illustration of somebody who performed a needed function at a particular time. And that was really all that was wanted. So my son-in-law is just reading a book, which I'm sure many of you have read. It was finally printed by the Paulus Fathers, Paulus Press, called Servant Leadership by Robert K. Greenleaf, who stirred up a lot in academe and in an industrial world. He was one of the high muckety-mucks in AT&T before he resigned here a few years ago. And the point of that book, and it's a radical notion, that if we could ever understand an industry, and that's what he was really trying to impress his own company with, understand that a de-emphasis on status and a greater emphasis on the functions and those varying functions that tie together to do the job that needs to be done would be a much better way to go. We have a few hints of that from some of the European automakers and especially the Japanese in our own day. So it isn't just pie in the sky kind of stuff, and it's not sentimental stuff either. It's some pretty potent kinds of things. The church has got to get at what it means, you know, this whole business of status. I think of the story that's told about the young Yale graduate who graduated 4.0 and was to go back into his father's business, and he was to be a, you know, kind of the star in the family crown, and was to take over the business eventually and all that. He'd done just very well in his studies, and at graduation time the family gathers together, and he turns to the family and said, "I decided, you know, that I'm not going back into the family business. I'm sorry, mother. I just can't see myself doing that. I've decided to go into Yale Divinity School, and I'm going to go into becoming a clergyman." And the mother's eyes began to glaze over and moist over, and pretty soon the tears began to flow, and she looked at him in exasperation, and she said, "Well, son, if you've got to be a preacher, at least try to be a bishop." Well, I think we've got that kind of notion. For instance, I think what the LCA and the ALC have done in the last few years to make a job that was known basically as a district president into a bishop is just one of the most artificial things we've done. It doesn't work because it has nothing to do with the historical meaning of a bishop. And I fought a lonely battle on that. I got up and spoke at our convention for the last time, and I must have had 300 people that came up to me afterwards and say, "Dave, that was really a fine speech. We were really all for you. You know, that really should never have passed." It passed about 690-3. So I don't know. But the point being that we, you know, I think we've got to get serious about this whole status business. I know that we're human beings, that we're were wired in certain ways. But what I came through a parish recently, a rather large parish, in which we did a team ministry, and we did it as a team ministry. It was all three of us had basically the same functions. We all shared in everything. We did have different functions as far as boards that we changed around once in a while. And I think that's only a kind of a pale illustration of what maybe the church has got to get busy doing in real serious nature. Now, I know there's an apostolic ministry as well, and I'll leave others to bring that up later on, but I'm trying to make the point, really, that we've veered a long ways away from where I think our Lord wants the church to be, in particularly in this hour. And maybe just to illustrate that very quickly, I'd just like to do a quick historical sketch, if you will. The biblical witness is very clear about this. There is absolutely no distinction made in the New Testament, and we can go back to the Old Testament and do some reviewing that builds up to this, but I have time for that. But there is absolutely no place for a distinction between the so-called clergy and laity. That's very clear. As Robinson and others have said, the two words kleros, from which we get clergy, and laos, from which we get laity, appear in the New Testament, but strange to say, they denote the same people, always, not different people. Lightfoot goes on and says that all Christians are God's laity and all are God's clergy. That's clear from his understanding of the New Testament. Cramer, who's probably written, you know, the kind of classical volume in this whole business of the theology of the laity, says there is no shimmer of an idea of a definite body called clergy. Just because the biblical content and intent of the concepts of laos and clerus is essentially different from the meaning laity and clergy have historically acquired, it is confusing to use these terms with their very distinct connotations for biblical categories. Now, you know, that should be gone into a great deal more, but I just want to make the assertion at this point that there is no distinction between clergy and laity, and certainly not a distinction of status. That, I think, is quite clear in the New Testament. And that certain people are set aside for certain functions, that's very clear in the book of Acts and in many other places. But in terms of status, there I think we would really have to do a lot of gymnastics in order to make it come out that somehow there was a status in not only the New Testament witness, but in the early church. It doesn't come till about the third or fourth century that you begin to get this whole distinction being made, and it's made very directly, as we all know, and from that time forth, it's really stuck with the church, and whatever else people have fulminated about it, it hasn't done much good. There's this famous quotation from Eusebius around 315, who says, two ways of life were thus given by the law of Christ to his church. The one is above nature and beyond common human living. It admits not marriage, childbearing, property, nor the possession of wealth, but wholly and permanently separates from the common customary life of mankind. It devotes itself to the service of God alone in its wealth of heavenly love. Such, then, is the perfect form of the Christian life. And the other, more humble, more human, permits men to join in pure nuptials and to produce children, to undertake government, to give orders to soldiers fighting for right. It allows them to have minds for farming, for trade, and other more secular interests as well as for religion. And it is for them that times of retreat and instruction and days for hearing sacred things are set apart. And a kind of secondary grade of piety is attributed to them. Well, with that kind of formulation of what the church was about, it wasn't long, of course, between that distinction became very sharp and very distinguished, and we began to develop a hierarchy and a very status-conscious organization. This was not so true immediately or even into the fourth century so much for the Orthodox tradition, where the mystique of those who were the purveyors of the gifts of God, whether by word or sacrament, were not necessarily then ascribed to have some kind of special holy aura about them. They were simply functionaries at that task that they were set aside to do. So you have then that very sharp departure along about that period, and never really called into question that I can find historically until, of course, the Reformation. And there you have this very strong theme, certainly in early Luther, but even beyond, and in Calvin, although they came at it quite differently. And if you've read this little thing that the Campus Ministry has put out, republished, which is a classic, Einar Billings on Our Calling, you know how strongly he emphasizes Luther's putting all of this under the understanding of the grace of God and the forgiveness of Christ. That without that, why, you know, all that we can talk about as far as the calling of God really doesn't have great meaning. But then it became then, for some historians, I think this is interesting, as they viewed it, perhaps more sociologically than anything else, the Reformation was not really a result of great doctrinal upheaval. It was rather a challenge to the hierarchy, which certainly was tied into Luther's concept of calling or vocatio, or that every single person baptized as they were was called by God and had a holy calling, as holy as, well, as he would say, certainly more holy than the bishops or the cardinals or especially the Pope. You know, all of these stories, some of them apocryphal, that Luther said in his table talks and other places about that were you know, you got the feeling he vented some spleen in saying these things, but nevertheless, it was definitely a part of his doctrinal understandings that all baptized Christians had ordination papers, and that was very clear. I think it's probably interesting to note that in some ways he and Calvin did come at it quite differently, in ways that, which of course Calvin would talk about the orders of creation. Luther talked about obviously the love and grace of God that gives these callings some meaning. Calvin always talked about the fact that we did our farming to the glory of God, and Luther would say, following the two kingdoms concept, which might have helped us a little bit last night in our discussion, that of course, you know, you'd never talk about doing your housework to the glory of God. That's pure nonsense. You do it for the sake of others, as Bonhoeffer says, that you are the person for others, or you are not really fulfilling what God's calling is all about. There is that very sharp distinction between Calvin and Luther, but that's part of their theological distinction as well. But that was a very, you know, sizable part of the Reformation, at least in the thought. It never got really carried through very much, and certainly has not since that time. I would say, coming very quickly to the relatively modern period, a generation ago, there was just an enormous interest in the subject. Some of you remember a spate of books that came out at that time. Cramer's Theology of the Laity, of course, was a kind of a classic. Trueblood was doing all kinds of writing. Many people think of his Your Other Vocation as kind of a little classic. Billing writing about our calling. Wingren, Luther on Vocation. Probably the best was written by, at least known, is written by Don Higas, who used to be head of Campus Ministry, was at that time then when he wrote it, called Our Christian Calling. And the interesting thing about all of this is there was a lot of interest in this, and all kinds of reform movements, and all of them were, you know, kind of looking at this and all of that. And the interesting thing now is that every one of those books, as far as I know, are out of print. Billing is now reprinted by Campus Ministry, but that's the only one, and that's really a pamphlet. So that there's very little literature in this field that you can really put your hands on. Some reformed literature, I referred to Lightfoot and others, that has been reprinted, but other than that, it's pretty scarce. I think that's an interesting thing. I would make the statement, for instance, that of all the reform movements that were coming in both Europe and America in 30 years ago, practically all of them are now dead, deceased. They no longer exist, except for, you know, a few. One of them that I think of is the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C., which, as a kind of a cornerstone of its whole theological understanding at that time, and later developed a much wider theological base that I think is very wholesome and more Lutheran than we Lutherans many times, this was one of the cornerstones. They took seriously the whole matter of the priesthood of believers, and that all have a calling from God. Where are we now? I don't think we're any further along. I can't see that we are, at least in in the Lutheran Church than we were a generation ago, except for one very interesting movement that some of you know something about, and that's so-called Laocoon ministry that's begun out of the head and heart of Bill Deal, Executive Vice President of Bethlehem Steel, who very cleverly set up this movement to be kind of a parastructure alongside of the LCA, and not too closely connected, but you know, there's enough identification there to make it a Lutheran movement. And it's the healthiest movement I've seen, you know, is all the movements that are going on right now. This is got the most health in my book. And why the ALC sits on its duff and says, you know, we'll look at this for a while and maybe we'll buy into it in 1999, you know, that is really a problem for me, but I have not been able to make much of a mark on that. But that is, of course, something that's stirring, and there are a few things that are stirring now. It'll be interesting to see in the new church body that affects at least the AELC and the LCA and the ALC among us here that is coming up now. What is required is after the fall conventions in 72, they are asking that the so-called commission on the new church come up with three documents. One is a rather major document. The Arne Mikkelsen, who's going to be the executive director, says it ought to be about that thick, and it's called The Shape of the Church. What is the church really going to look like organizationally? That'll be interesting. The other is a statement, of course, doctrinal in nature. What shall we say is our statement of faith, which took the ALC years to develop before their last merger. Then another little kicker in there is that they shall come up with a series of ecclesial principles, which I think it is fair to say has never been dealt with. It has not been dealt with. You know, you can search the confessions, and maybe some of the rest of you who are confessional scholars can come up with something here, but you really cannot find what I like to call an ecclesiology for the modern world, at least. There's very few hints of a real strong ecclesiology in the confessions, nor in the writings, nor in anything else. My theory is that there aren't very many theologians around that really care about this. I can't name you any. I don't know all that many, but I can't name you any. You know, I don't know if it's just the fact that you sit in a seminary and you don't have to ever deal with structures. Maybe that's it. At least I don't see any real wrestling with what we might call ecclesial principles, which I think we'll have to, you know, definitely take seriously the role of the laity in any new church body. And to say, for instance, that we have conventions now, grandly, we say this, you know, we've got conventions now that have 50% laity coming to them. Marvelous, marvelous. Great progress we've made, you know, in 40 years. You know, when we come to the point where we have to ask whether we can allow more than 2% of the clergy to come to convention, then we'll get serious about the implications of all of this. And, you know, maybe with that we ought to just open it up for a little while. I'm just trying to give you a little view of what I think are some of the more salient elements of the history of this whole thing, starting with the idea, then I have to say, as the main contention, the biblical witness refuses to make a distinction, certainly in terms of status, but even a distinction in clergy and laity. And we've come a long ways from that. Yes?
May I add another historical note? In the 60s, particularly in the American Lutheran Church, when the question of ordination of women was being studied, of course, there was a lot of study of what is ordination per se.
Yes.
And our ad hoc committee, in preparation for the 1970 convention, did a lot of study of what is involved in ordination. And I remember the point being made that the scripture is not terribly clear on just what is ordination.
Yes.
And so if you don't have that kind of clarity, obviously you can't make a distinction limiting ordination to one kind of person. And so that kind of study really helped pave the way for the ordination of women then, as approved by the 1970.
One of my friends did a study, which is kind of an old-fashioned study, on the so-called inner call and outer call thing here recently, trying to figure out, you know, how many people who are in the clergy have an inner call, and well, needless to say, the blurring of all of this inner and outer call business has really come about in the last 20 years to the point where that's very I could tell you some stories about people who I know that were 4 years old and wanted to be a lawyer in the worst way, Now, if you call that a less holy inner call than mine, I think you're really, you know, barking up the wrong tree. But that was a help, I think, when we had to finally face that, the meaning of ordination as it applied to women clergy. Yes.
Would you care to comment on your viewpoint as to the role of the bishop / district president?
Oh boy, I think that's a whole different topic. I think historically there's some clear lines. Obviously the two major roles were to be a teacher and to be a pastor, not pastor to pastors, which is the formula that's been given, but pastor to people. And of course they were in small enough provinces so that there was some possibility of being a pastor of people and to be a teacher in the best sense of that term. We have largely, you know, sort of pushed that over to our theological seminaries, which is okay. I think it's too bad that we are of such size and proportion that none of our bishops, some of whom, are, you know, unlike some others that I know very well, are quite talented, who really could be teachers, and we strap them down with all kinds of administrative stuff. That now the other side of it is Gordon Lathrop, who's done a little study on this for some of us, also came up with the amazing fact, even amazed him, that one of the major cornerstones of the job of the bishop in the early church was teaching, pastoring, administration, because there was some administration that had to be done. All I'm saying is that we make it a counterfeit word, because I know that if I'm trying to take care and manage 400 congregations, I'm not doing a lot of bishoping. Yes, go ahead.
To get back to your point about baptism as a form of ordination in a way, mm-hmm. Last fall I heard John Deschner of Perkins do a series of lectures on the role of the laity. And for those not familiar with John Deschner, he also serves as chair of the Faith and Order Conference of the World Council of Churches. He's an internationally known scholar. Lest you think he's a heretic, he had his first theology course at Texas Lutheran College. That's a miracle.
That ought to give you a good signal.
However, John Deschner pointed out that if we're talking about Christian unity, which is really a concern, and Christian unity beyond what we have now, said that one of the sticking points is precisely this business of ordination, and that if the concept of baptism as ordination could be more universally accepted in terms of the understanding of the role of persons, I mean, that would be helpful, because it is over this ecclesiology and, you know, the episcopate and all this kind of thing, that's one of the main barriers to Christian unity among, let's say, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, or, let's say, Episcopal, Anglican, or something of this type. Our understanding of the role of the clergy in relation to the laity is one of the main barriers to Christian unity, as pointed out by John Deschner. And apparently there is some good source material on some of the studies that have come out of Faith and Order at WCC.
Well, the most recent one, the revolutionary one, which has as its tag end the ministry, and makes them very, you know, and Bill Lazarus had a lot to do with formulating that statement, makes some very clear assertions along this line. Interesting, we could get into it, but the Episcopal Lutheran dialogue and the Anglican Lutheran dialogues that have been going on had this as a kind of a sticking point, but found a very beautiful resolution on it, and I think we're on the way now to really, you know, getting serious both about Lutheran unity and finding a new view of ordination that is much more universal.
Is that a publication, or are you talking about something that's published?
The new Faith and Order document.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that just getting published. Yes.
The Luther's distinction that priests are born, pastors are made. I think it's very helpful.
That's very good. That's very nice. Yes.
If
you can tell me how we can make pastors better, you know, please, I'll listen to you all night long. Excuse me.
If a particular local congregation wanted to adopt the philosophy that you talked about here, how would you see that congregation differing from what you see in a normal congregation?
Well, I you know, now you're dealing with my bias, and I'm just saying, yes. It would revolutionize a parish life, you know, if we really took seriously the ordination of every single member. You know, we see these bulletins now all the time. Jim Johnson, pastor, 3,000 members, priests of God, or whatever. You know, that kind of philosophy. But that doesn't take seriously the structural implications of what that means in a congregation. And while I can rejoice about the new Lutheran Book of Worship and its involvement of lay people, I hope that isn't confused with what I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about churchy activity. I'm talking about ordaining people into the life of the world. Now, see, what I would say there, it's like I had a fellow just before I left the parish come in and apologize all over the place because he didn't think he could take on the stewardship chairperson again. And he was up for, I knew he was up for being chairperson of the United Way in the community. And I said, man, there's no choice there. I mean, you have no business carrying on the job that you've been doing for us this past year. You get with it where you can do something really important for God's kingdom. I think that whole, see, how would we see stewardship, how would we see evangelism, how would we see parish education if underneath all of that, the calling of God was the base upon which every person was motivated to do what they did? Is that too theoretical or?
I just think that's the right question. I'm afraid that all the other approaches through those dialogues and everything going on, which all excite me, Bill Lazarus and the new church and everything else, I still say a generation from now would be sitting in a room like this saying similar things.
Yeah.
Unless we do have some parishes that maybe happening in your place that you ought to highlight some of those so people can see and touch and taste and feel some of the things that are different when that happens. I think that'll turn us on. It might turn some of the laity on. I don't see them being overwhelmed where I am about those moves.
Okay, I think we've got a prime example in the Church of the Savior, which I think is pretty much been limited. It started by Gordon Cosby, who was a big-time Baptist preacher. Really big time. I mean, he had flocks of people coming in. And I think it was through the service that he got touched by Elton Trueblood to ask the question, I got all these people coming, but what the devil am I giving them? You know, what is it worth, all of this? A lot of hoopla, a lot of noise, lots of fun, lots of joy, and all the rest. And he said, that's enough is enough. And so he went off into Washington, D.C., inner city, and formed this little nucleus that's never, I don't think, ever been a greater number than 120, where they have an apprenticeship, before you join, like 3 years. You decide through a lot of pain and struggle what Mary's book is about. You discover what are your gifts. And as finally the community decides along with yourself what your gifts are, then you are pointed in the direction to do something. Now your gift may be pointing you of all places into we were just there recently, into a big apartment house that wasn't very far from their little bookstore. And the apartment house, of course, is just in absolute ruins. We walked into there with a person who, with one other person in that community, is supposed to transform that place into a livable habitat. And you go in there, and of course, your urinal stench is so bad you cannot stand in one spot for more than just a couple of minutes. And then they're working at trying to gain the confidence of the people in that building. First of all, that they're not going to get kicked out. Secondly, that they're going to work together to try to refurbish that place so that it's a livable place once again, a place where some kind of grace can be given. Now that was, that was for a few in that community, a very few, two or three actually, was the place that they were pointed to do ministry. Not that they didn't have ministry also down in downtown Washington every day of the week, but this was part of their extra hours. Their pledge is to not only tithe, but to regularly read the word, regularly have worship, and to give oneself devoted to the poor, to some cause of justice. Now that's a commitment that you have to be pretty serious about. And most people just don't get mixed up with it unless they have gone through that 3-year apprentice period and begun to say, the reason that I became very interested in it is because in Iowa we've got a lot of churches that are under 200. And what are we doing? You know, we're slipping farther and farther behind. We don't need to worry, well, we need to worry about it, but the churches that are 3,000 in size are going to make it, you know. The 200 may not. And it may be a survival question for a lot of churches in the Lutheran Church. Until we get a little serious about what our ministry is about, our mission is about, I don't think we'll get very far. But you're right, Elmer. I think, you know, until this is demonstrated in congregation, we can put out World Council papers and we can put out, you know, all, we can argue. We did argue. Youth offices 30 years ago were into this in spades. And one of the great executives of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, we'd come together, he would meet with us. I don't know why he was meeting with us. I guess he was checking up and seeing if we were all right. But we'd keep saying, you know, at the end of the session, we'd say, well, at least we're done talking about full-time Christian service, aren't we, folks? Huh? You know, full-time Christian service? What the heck does that mean? And then as soon as we'd reconvene again, he'd get up and he'd say, well, now today we're going to talk about full-time Christian service, folks, again, and we'll take this a little further. Well, it was that kind of thing. You just go around chasing your tail until it's put in some concrete form in, I'd say, parish or congregational life. Pretty true.
Are you suggesting possibly that we consider something, like I've heard of Small Disciples of Church congregation does in Des Moines, your town of Des Moines? Before they become a member of the congregation, they are to commit themselves to certain things. It's called a covenant with the Lord, that they will serve the Lord in these specific ways.
Well, I'm saying...
I mean, is that one specific way that this could be approached? Or
I guess what I am saying is that is what the Church of the Savior has done, and some others have done. But the stumbling block there is whether you can do that in the name of the gospel or whether you do it in the name of the law. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of churches that have gone and died 20 years later because they never understood what the gospel is about. Mm-hmm. The Church of the Savior is very clear about that. You know, they kid each other more than they maybe even do around Holden. I mean, there's no phony kinds of, you know, that just isn't part of their makeup. Yes.
My husband just reminded me to tell you about something they're doing in Zimbabwe right now.
Yeah.
A lady was in our home this fall from Zimbabwe, and she is a Lutheran lady, very active in her church and very active with survival too. But the women, if they choose to, can become a Vashindiri, which means a worker of God. They, if they say they want to do this, they have to be an apprentice for 1 year to see if they really like what this role means. And if they are successful after that year, then they are taken into this. And so they're not looked down on if they don't do it, but this is an opportunity you have. She didn't say anything about the men, so I don't know if they have anything like this for men or not. But if you are a Vashindiri, it means that you have said, I will do what God wants me to do. If they are elected to be president of a circle or whatever their equivalent of circle is, they cannot say no, because if they are chosen by the church people, that's God who's asked them to do this. Or if the pastor asks them to lead a study, then they lead a study because that's God that's spoken to them. Anicia was chosen by a convention to come to America because the American Lutheran Church women in the North Pacific District had made these arrangements. We wanted to have a layperson over here on a woman-to-woman exchange. And she was chosen. And she said, how can I do this? I have a year-old baby. I'm still nursing this baby. And they said, God will show you the way. She had no choice. She would come. Her sister took her year-old baby, and the rest of the seven children were taken care of, and Anicia came. Of course, she also had the ability and the education to fill this role, too, beautifully. But they lived that simple faith, and it happens in Zimbabwe.
Beautiful example of what we really meant several years ago when we talked about sending churches. The only sending churches that I've seen that have really worked, that didn't come over to impose their own lifestyle and cultural attitudes on others, has been the Third World Church right now. It's full of vitality. There's things like that happening all over the place. You know, and we sit back and wonder, you know, if they're going to make it over there. Well, you know, as far as... You know, basic to this whole concept, it seems to me, is whether or not you can finally come to grips with what it means not to have to separate the body from the spirit. That's a long way around, I suppose. But the point being that the third world people are not hung up by that. And so there isn't all of this kind of spiritual stuff over here as if that didn't have anything to do with the way life is lived out. And it seems to me that's what this lady represents for. She becomes a symbol of what it means to be not only serious about the faith, but to be a kind of a joyful witness. And your key to me was to say, you know, if other women didn't choose to do that, they're not looked down upon. See, that's the difference between whether you're going to make this into a nice, tight little click or whether you're going to do this by the law or by the gospel.
I have to laugh, though. There's a lot of humanness in all of us, though. This gal was just a full of sense of humor. These, if they're Vashandiri, they wear a uniform because some of the ladies only have one dress to wear, and they don't want those who have three dresses to make the ones who have only one feel bad because they can change their dress sometimes. So they all wear this simple uniform. But then what happened? Some of them who had earrings started wearing it, and some who had a necklace started wearing it. So there's an awful lot of humanness involved. So they had to make some rules about
that. Can you imagine what they'd do if the men were doing it?
Rather than talking about ordaining more in different functions, is it possible or would it be easier to talk about not ordaining anybody and emphasizing baptismal gifts?
I think that's possible. I think one of the big problems that you're pointing up is that you know, there's no way, I hope I haven't given the impression that there's any way, that you can somehow equate vocation, calling, with occupation. You know, I think that's a dead-end street. In Luther's day, that was a lot easier kind of thing because the orders of life were a little clearer and there wasn't that kind of thing. I'd be prepared to say, yes, I think that's maybe the only way we're going to get over our hang-ups on this thing, and maybe we just have to back away from, there are churches now that gather all of their teachers and they ordain them on Sunday morning, and they gather all the other people and they ordain them, and there's some meaning to that for many people, but I think, you know, I think of the guy that I used to work with. It's an old story of mine, but I think of the guy that I used to work with in the meatpacking plant when I was going to college, and all he did all day long, and I kid you not, was cut off the tail of the pig. I mean, that was his job, you know. And if I was to come up, sidle up to him at the lunch hour and say, well, you know, Fred, you know, I hope you see that you're doing God's holy work while you're cutting off that tail. I mean, you know, I would have gone out of there with less teeth than I came in. The facts of the matter was that the guy had a marvelous personality. And, you know, whenever he came into the lunchroom, everybody kind of lit up. You know, that was kind of... So it was his vocation was in terms of his relationships and not in terms of his his tasks. I don't have great hopes that the church is going to back away from ordination into holy ministry. But maybe that's the only way we'll come to it. I think I have to pick up an Elmer's theme, though. I'd say that if we got serious about congregational life and what this all implies for congregational life, then I'd have some hope that the church, you know, could be empowered as I think the Holy Spirit is calling us to be empowered.
I would want to see the church to emphasize ordination along like the baptismal. We all are baptized into the Lord. Why can't we all be ordained, you know, although... I don't mean in the sense of a ceremony as such, but if we're reminded so often, I think we'll take on some of the leadership role and start really acting out some of our lives.
Okay. I sat under Charlie Mays as a pastor. Oh, here he is. I shouldn't tell about him, but we were in his congregation in Virginia, and it always amused me because we'd come from a congregation where the pastor was the Herr Pastor. I mean, he did everything, and he would have all his committees meet in one night, and then you'd sit in the committee and you'd brainstorm and you'd really get enthused about something, and then he'd visit, you know, in the last 15 minutes, all the committees. And they with great enthusiasm, they'd tell him what we decided to do, Pastor. And the pastor would say, oh, no, you can't do that. We've never done that before. You're not going to do that with me. No, sir. And so he'd squelch every benevolent impulse that ever was around there. Then we came out to Charlie's congregation, and here he was trying to get people, you know, to be unloosed from the pastor. And I'd sit in with committee meetings, and I'd just see the pain through Charlie's system as they'd say, well, but... Do you think we can do this, Pastor? I mean, are we here? Are you know, grade 13 bureaucrats who had made decisions, you know, probably $3 million that day, you know, knowing that as soon as they put on their hat for the church, their ordination hat, they could no longer make any decisions, but they had to ask the pastor about everything. So we got a long ways to go, is all I'm trying to say, and I don't know, you know. So it isn't just a hang up of the pastors. It's a hang up of a lot of lay people that don't want that. Yes?
It seems to me like the hang up that I see is the major portion is the laity. I think a lot of pastors understand and are begging for that relationship so that they can have the laity take on the fullness of their callings. But there's so many laity and there's so few pastors that I think that the pastors have a real job on their hands to convince us all that we're ordained.
I think we got a lot going, a lot needing in both directions. I find that to be more true than I'd like to admit. We had a district convention in which this subject came up in a general way, and I heard some pastors say some things that made me ashamed, you know, of that I was a part of the clergy roster. I really think that was unfortunate. On the other hand, I think you're right. There's a lot of lay people that are very reluctant to really dig into this very deeply. The beautiful part of it, though, I think, is that unlike an awful lot of past generations, I don't see in all of this a kind of anti-clerical spirit. Now, maybe I'm just completely naive at this point, but I do not see people charging ahead and saying, I'd like to be fulfilled in terms of what my ordination means in the life of the world, not here in this little congregation, but in the life of the world. And I don't see that as a kind of an anti-clerical thing at all. I see it just quite the opposite. Pastor, can you equip me as a saint of God, you know, to be in the life of the world? Bill Deal say that.
I remember one quote, and I can't tell you who said it, but it's, you probably know. It's in relationship to the saying that our brother doesn't need a keeper, he needs a brother. And that being the case, I think the laity need to see the pastor as a brother rather than someone to serve them. As much. A co-worker.
That's good point. Yeah. Right.
The more I think about it, it seems to me as if maybe it's a sociological problem, because about everybody who's who is a layperson works in some industry or profession where there usually is bureaucracy and hierarchy, and there's not true equality in working, and they work that way all day, and as they come into the church, they look to the pastor to be, quote, the boss,
yeah,
and to tell them what to do. And I think that's maybe it's built into our culture and our society, the basic...
Well, worse than that, we have aped, you know, so that we built around an industrial model to build the church, which is just absolutely... Even long after the industrial model was no longer regarded as valid. And so that now we have a situation where the pastor becomes not only in that model the executive director of the congregation, he's also chairman of the board. And you know, that just doesn't quite wash. So we've got some things to clean up there. I know now why they put me up against, you know, the main thing in there, because it's like a piece of bologna, you know, you can cut it off anywhere and it just sort of